on the website catalystsexpositive.com. BDSM and ritual. Ritual and BDSM with Patrick Califia.
Yeah.
From 1 until 3 p.m.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick and Teresa. Sorry, I merged your names together there.
Oh my God, it's like Brangela.
Patrick, Teresa, thank you so much. Okay. We'll see you and everybody else, the whole world, at Thrill the World on Saturday.
Yay, zombie makeup. Yay.
Catholic Gated Conversations is up next. Thanks to Somia for making all of this possible in the booth. Blessings, everyone.
Homeless people. They're some of the most vulnerable and misunderstood folks in our communities. Season 3 of Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, is dedicated to telling the story of how a group of local people is working to provide needed services to folks who are experiencing homelessness. Episode 1 introduces the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center and the people at the center who give and receive help and support. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studio in Portland. Educata Ya hosts Dia de los Muertos featuring decorative altars, people dressed up as Katrinas, reading of the satirical Calaveras, and a traditional Pan de Muerto. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studios, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to KBOO. KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken. The show has been pre-recorded.
This is the wonderful Calculated Conversation Radio Show. The reason being, because there's certain things we just got to talk about.
Yes,
yes. I'm your host, David Jefferson, and
Ken Jones
is in the house. And we also got a very, very special guest, man. Casey Jackson is definitely in the building tonight, man. What's up, Casey?
It's good to be here.
Man, we're glad to have you, man. Casey has been in behavioral health over 30 years.
Yes.
What it says here is that you are the International Motivational Interviewing Network competency assessment boss man, pretty much.
Something like that. Yeah. It's all propaganda, but yeah, that's true.
Right. Yeah. And so you provided over 2,000 trainings on motivational interviewing. That's why we're here, the idea of motivational interviewing.
Yes.
I had the pleasure to attend one of your trainings with Central City Concern about 4 months ago, and I was just blown away, you know, by the level of depth you guys were going to bring awareness and empathy and understanding to, you know, other people's traumas, experiences in life, things that we normally wouldn't know anything about. And I was like, man, I got to talk to him somehow about this, you know. So it was amazing to me, and I've been telling my co-hosts about it, you know, for the last, you know, couple of months, you know, trying to get this thing set up. Also, you do this around the country, right? Don't you? You travel and you teach the philosophies, the ideas, the curriculum of motivational interviewing to different types of organizations. What all organizations do you work with?
Well, actually, even recently, I've been traveling all over the world. I just got back from the UK and was in Poland this year, and so I've been really lucky. The organizations, like it said, you know, I've worked in behavioral health, mental health, and addiction for over 30 years.
Right.
You know, worked with homeless youth and worked in prison systems, and as a social worker, And I ran across this method of communication and just became obsessed with it. And at the time, I was at Washington State University on faculty there and just had a chance to dive deeper into the research and the science behind why it works. And so it's kind of a balance between the compassion that I had wanting to change the world and then having a method of communication that aligns with that and continues to improve. And so that's, when you look at it from that lens, it started in the addiction world, and now I train organizations that work with employment services, people that have been incarcerated getting to employment. I work with state government, with welfare offices. I work with, you know, addiction agencies. I work with mental health agencies, work with hospitals, just any organization that really is trying to make a change.
What I like the most, well, one of the things I like is that you work with law enforcement.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think what really turned me on to the motivational interviewing was the de-escalation process, because I remember in the training, it stuck out to me that you guys showed a real life police officer using some of the tactics of motivational interviewing to de-escalate a very, very hazardous and dangerous situation.
Yes.
And it worked.
It works.
And I was like, okay, so this is real.
This is real.
You know,
something I wanted to make sure. So for the listeners that don't know,
yes.
I just got up to speed with what motivational interviewing was.
Right. So. I wanted to go back to that, but I was so excited to say that part. But yeah, right. We got to get back to what motivational interviewing actually is.
Break that down and define
it. What does that mean exactly?
So I'll give you just a quick history. So the individual that developed it, Dr. William Miller, has been around for decades. And in the 80s, he went on sabbatical. He's at University of New Mexico, Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
He went on sabbatical, and I can never remember. It was one of the Scandinavian countries. And they were expecting in the 80s. I was raised in the addiction field in the 80s.
Okay.
And it's abusive. It was it's what I was trained to do, but it's a really aggressive, abusive system, addiction treatment is. You verbally beat people up. You break them down. Mm. If they're not ready to quit using, you know, you go back on the streets and figure it out and then come back and talk to me.
Mm.
It's just a pretty aggressive system. And the failure rates were always blamed on the individuals because they have drug addiction.
Mm.
It was never blamed on the professionals that maybe didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Right.
And what Miller did when he went over there, they were asking him why he was doing it the way he was doing it, because they were expecting to get this kind of aggressive treatment approach that they knew was coming out of the States. And that's not the way Bill Miller operated. So where the term actually came from, he said he didn't think anybody would actually read what he was writing about it.
Right.
But what he realized is when you get aggressive with anybody, they get defensive.
Right.
It doesn't matter if you have addiction issues or not.
Right.
If you
get
in somebody's face and get aggressive, people are going to get aggressive back.
Yes.
You don't have to have addiction issues. You don't have to be struggling with alcoholism.
Right.
So it's a pretty common sense aha moment. And what he told the students, these grad students, was because they were going, why are you doing it this way? And he said, well, what I've learned is if you just interview people, they're more than willing to talk if you don't judge them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when I interview people, and this is where motivational interviewing came from, he said, when I interviewed people, I could see these big gaps between their behavior and who they said they were.
Right.
And so I would interview them to find out, now that I could understand, when I step inside their skin and understand the struggles they've gone through and what they've gone through in life, I just wanted to find out what would motivate you. Why would you even think about quitting using drugs?
Right.
And that's where the term motivational interviewing came from. He interviewed people to find out what motivated them. And he never expected it to go international. He didn't expect people to start to research it. He didn't expect it to kind of blow up to the level that it has in the last 40 years. And so that was in 83. Another individual from Wales read the article, and they ran into each other at a conference, and they wrote a book, and it just grew and grew and grew. And now, like what I used to teach 15 years ago, because of the research that's come out around it, I don't even teach some of the same stuff because we've learned through research that things we thought were impacting behavior change don't necessarily change behavior, and other things we weren't paying attention to, we pay more attention to. So that's where the term motivational interviewing came from, is you interview people to find out what motivates them.
Okay. Nice, man. I love it.
Which is, it's the complexity, it sounds, but it is exactly what it's, what's right there in your face.
Exactly. It's
right there.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's to be able to, you know, take a look into those. It's why we do what we do, and that's why we're glad we connected with you. You don't really find a lot of people, organizations, you know, trainers, podcasts, radio shows, whatever, that really go deep enough into the why. Can't always talk about the why.
Right.
You know,
and I get along good, Ken.
Yes.
Ken always talk about the why, you know, and
concern.
You know, and he, you know, and starting from there, you can start to probe and you can start to understand and go deeper and kind of let go a lot of your preconceived notions of what, why you think people do what they do based off your own limited experience.
Absolutely.
Right. And so, what you're doing is amazing, man. You've been out of the country as well. Yes. Now you've always been international, or is this new?
It's not predominantly. I'm in country.
Okay.
I mean, it's weird to even say that because I'm just a little scrub kid from 6th and Bowdish in Spokane, Washington. So when I think that I've been to Australia and trained and Germany and been other places, it blows my mind because I was just a little social worker who wanted to, you know, give me some obnoxious teenagers, lock me in a room with them, let's get honest with each other, and hopefully that's gonna help change things. That's all I ever wanted to do. So to be here on a conversation like and then to be traveling around the country, or even traveling around the world, it's mind blowing to me.
Right. And so we'll have the listeners know that he flew in just to do this interview.
Right.
We feel super special. And he's flying out right after. So you won't get to see him. No, we're just kidding. But no, we blessed that you came in, man. Like, again, I was, for a guy like myself who thinks he knows a bit about communication and a bit about empathy and awareness, being open-minded enough to hear you out, you know, I was able to learn new information. So as much as I think I know, it showed me how much I didn't know, which I was extremely grateful for, man. That's why, again, I wanted to connect with you on that level. I kind of wanted to talk about some of the actual details of MI, but before that, I didn't know.
I was just going to vouch for, because usually his excitement, he keeps it here, but when certain things hit him, we had finished the show and he brought it up like, man, heard this guy speak, and it just, I thought I knew something, and I realized that it's way more than enough. So he was crazy excited, so that's good. Not fluff.
Good.
Right. I don't do that often, because I rarely hear things like, you know, that get me on that level, man, but I just want to make sure I'm open-minded about the idea of other people and how and why they exist and what I can do to be better, and, you know, and the listeners, I think, you know, outside from me and Ken, we want to make sure our listeners are up to date on the idea of motivational interviewing and how it can impact and how they can utilize you guys' service, connect with you in the future, or possibly bring you to their organization and, you know, go deeper, you know, on the subject. Let me see where we at. Okay, so there's a lot of different facets of motivational interviewing. What would you say is the first step? Is there a process, right?
Yeah, and I think the thing that is impactful for me, or powerful for me, of why you even sat up straight in the training. I mean, you even talked to me the very first break. I remember you coming up to the break saying, you know, like,
I'm crazy. Yeah.
I was kind of half in this and kind of half out of this, and like, now I'm in this.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's wildly different than calculated conversations. It's literally, do we pay attention to what's coming out of our mouth and how it's impacting people around
Absolutely.
Us?
Absolutely.
And so I think one of the reasons that I've gotten a little more attention, because I'm not the only person that trains on motivational interviewing, but I have gotten a little bit of attention around it, is because I really do want to have a profound impact for people that serve other people and actually improve communities.
Right.
And so, like, I've been told many times, like, you can't use motivational interviewing for this, or you can't use it for this, you can't use it for this. And I keep thinking, why can't I be mindful about, when I open my mouth, the impact that's having?
Right.
I don't care if I'm talking to my children. I don't care if I'm an officer talking to somebody that I pull over. Doesn't matter if I'm a doctor talking to somebody with diabetes. I can be mindful and conscious about what's coming out of my mouth.
Yes.
And I can listen more deeply into what impact is it having. And I have a lot of kind of controversial biases in my own field, but I think if there's a problem, if I'm the person getting paid to fix this problem and it's not going well, that's on me. That's not on the patient or the client I'm working with. That just means if you're taking a paycheck, you need to lay down some service that's working. And if you're not, then you need to go back to the drawing board and figure that out, and not blame the individual.
Right.
So those are the things that I think it starts to push a basic method of communication into individual change. And that's why when I started my company, I was thinking, I want individual change, I want organizational change, I want community change, I want system change in a really proactive, smart, strategic way that can have a sustained impact on individuals and communities.
Right.
And I've seen it happen consistently if people
Yes.
Follow the basic structure that you need to follow in this method of communication.
Right. I got a question. Do you think that with kind of your background going, you know, being in the mental health field, dealing with adolescents, mm-hmm. Then the prison system, that kind of helps set a foundation for you to be able to deal with essentially whatever stone your way?
I think so. I also think what I was lucky with, I was lucky with the family that I was raised in, that I was just raised to be a compassionate person.
Okay.
And so nice. I tended to lean a little higher in the empathy range anyway.
Okay.
And once I learned even more effectively to put, instead of just assuming what's going on with people, to really put myself in other people's shoes, it's really humbling to realize how ignorant you really are.
Right.
Like, who the hell am I to tell people how to live their lives? And
right.
I think about, but that's what we're trained to do as professionals.
Right.
Read more books, take more classes, get more initials after your name so you can really put your finger in somebody's chest and say, you need to do this or your life's not going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they actually are going to listen or care.
Right.
Like, why with somebody that I've just met, that their parent brings them in by the ear, just because I sit them down and put my finger in their chest and tell them what they need to do, why the hell are they going to listen to me? I mean,
right.
it just, when you look at it almost mathematically, it doesn't make sense,
right.
but it's what our mainstream culture does.
Right.
It's
right.
what a professional culture assumes is the most effective thing to do. But then when you look at the data behind it, then you get to blame people. Well, this intervention is only about 40% effective or 50% effective.
Right.
And historically what we did is we'd blame the individuals for their diabetes, their heart disease, their obesity.
Right.
You know, we could blame them for their choices instead of going, well, maybe professionals just aren't on top of the game like they should be.
Right.
You know, they can learn more advanced skills of communication and how to affect behavior change instead of just handing them a brochure and
right.
making them feel guilty. I mean, it's just not effective.
So you touch on kind of saying your family structure set up you leaning towards the empathy. What are some of the things that you can recall that you feel were done differently than maybe just in general, things that you come across that kind of help that?
And like in my own personal life.
Yeah,
yes,
like your family. Like.
Yeah, I think the thing that I know is I was basically in, you know, not poverty. I mean, I thought I was raised in poverty, but not extreme poverty.
Right.
But like my parents talked about, like they had, like when my dad used to get his paycheck, they had maybe a nickel in their savings and checking together, like total, like literally a nickel. Right. And which means that they had money in their account. So I realized it wasn't poverty. They had money. They had a nickel. So, right. So I understand that. But I never knew that. Like right. growing up, because my parents were so involved in our lives, and I have six siblings, and so we had a big family, but we were always doing stuff. And my dad worked horrible. He went to work at, you know, 2:30 in the morning, and he'd get home at 4:30 in the evening. He only had Wednesdays and Sundays off. He had split days off for 30 years. But he was involved in it. He was a coach. He was the pack leader for Cub Scouts. My mom coached. She was den mother. Like they were just so active. We didn't know we were poor.
Okay.
And I think, as I got older, I had such an appreciation. They didn't try to insulate it for us. They didn't think they were poor. They knew that we had a rich life. And my mom just always said, you know, you really want to make a difference in people's lives. Like, and when people found out that I had like six siblings, they're like, oh, are you Mormon or are you Catholic? And it's like, my parents were just horny.
right.
And they went to baseball team. And,
right.
And people would ask what my religion was. Like, and I remember when kids were going to church and everybody's talking about going to church on Sundays and we didn't go to church. And I asked my mom one day, you know, what religion are we? I remember I was in grade school and she said, well, why? And I said, well, because everybody talks about church. And she goes, well, if they ask you, just tell them you're Christian because you'd give your shirt off your back to anybody that needs it. Mm. And she goes, and that's what Christ would do.
Mm.
And so I was like, okay, I'm Christian, I guess, because I would give my shirt off my back to anybody that needs help. So that's the kind of family that I came from. And my mom was an activist and did all sorts of things that really had a major impact on her community, even coming from not a lot of money. So
okay. Well, that helps. That helps paint a clearer picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like that, man, that building that energy. And a lot of families weren't fortunate enough to kind of have that type of rearing,
exactly.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what makes it tougher for them to, you know, even be considerate, compassionate, empathetic of people in general. And so MI is sort of a program, a philosophy that is, you know, asking you to go deeper, you know, challenge you to go deeper into your own understanding.
And to leave your own reality. And it's hard for
you. Yeah, right.
And that's, we tend to want to stick with our reality. I mean, we're pretty egocentric creatures, especially in mainstream U.S. We're very egocentric, and we're always trying to drag people into our reality. You look at Facebook, you look at any social media, everybody, you want to drag everybody into your reality, and we get so self-centered. It's really powerful because it's so uncommon when somebody leaves their reality to step inside your reality with no agenda and no judgment. Like, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
But when someone does that, that's the fundamental construct you're asking about earlier about motivational interviewing. And the fundamental construct is you leave your worldview to step inside somebody else's worldview without judgment. And when you do that, it eliminates most tension or conflict in a conversation because you're not trying to prove your point. You're stepping to their worldview, so you eliminate the resistance and you get access to their struggle or their ambivalence internally. So it's very effective, but we just don't do it well.
Right.
I think part of the conversation we were having on Saturday, a sidebar conversation where I was just talking about your east, the further you get west, you know, it goes from group to I. And it goes, it's way less we, even in the way, you know, our just language, just the English language.
Yes.
It's, we're blaming.
Yes.
Right.
Things don't just, it's he did it, she did it, this was, and what that does for us.
Right.
And it's separate. Everything is separate. And it's almost weird. We talk about coming across people and then being nice, just genuinely nice, and how you're kind of like, oh, what's the angle?
What's going on?
What I owe you.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And it's just crazy that that's like that. I had a moment, this is maybe 2 years ago, genuinely seeing somebody walking by, genuinely happy. Like, he was looking at the trees. Nice sunny day, and you ever been under a tree and kind of the sunlight is coming through it and it's kind of a cool, and he was just in awe and walked away and smiling. My first thought was like, is he high?
Right.
It's like, why can't he just be appreciate? And that was one of those things that I followed up that thought with, right. Why am I even questioning what state he's in as opposed to just being happy?
Right.
That tripped me out and made me feel I defaulted to that. But it's just crazy how often we come across people who are just genuinely good people, and it takes a second to warm up to that.
Yes.
Because that's not what we're expecting. That's not what we're exposed to on a regular.
Yes.
That is frustrating.
Well, and Cam, this is part of the construct that's so fascinating about it. And this is a cross-cultural, you know, the more I've really studied this and dove into it, just looking at the cross-cultural application of it, fundamentally, and this is going to start to go into your why question a little bit, or perspective.
Yes.
Is when you get crystal clear, when you talk about or you think about what your deeper values are, what your values and what your goals are, when your behavior is not in line with it and you catch yourself or someone else catches you, your first reaction is to either blame outside yourself or make an excuse. So if you say you're trustworthy or you say you have integrity, and you catch yourself or someone else catches you not doing it, your knee-jerk reaction is to blame outside of yourself or to make an excuse. And so this is, when you look from that basic construct and somebody's looking up at the tree and they see the sun rays coming down and they're, it's part of you thinks, well, I want to be that way. And since I'm not every day, and most of us, so many people are walking around miserable or depressed or upset or angry, when they see somebody happy, they have to blame outside of themselves because their behavior is not in line with that reality. Because nobody's that happy.
Right, technically.
And if they are, they got to be smoking something. They got to be doing something. And which is all blaming outside the self instead of going, why don't I take time to look up that tree and see those? Because that would be in line with my values. But I have so many excuses that I blame everything and say why I can't do it instead of taking time to do it. And if somebody else takes the time to do it, then I've got to talk smack about them because they've got to be screwed up because, you know, nobody normally does those kind of things.
And I don't feel bad not doing it because it's not my fault that I'm not doing it.
That's exactly it.
That's funny you said that because I remember one time telling my ex, you know, that I missed her, and she was like, "Are you drunk?" I was like, "Yeah, but so what?" No, I'm kidding. And I wasn't either. I was sober, and I was like, "That's rude," you know. But it just shows that, I mean, people ain't always used to just that transparency, that compassion. And you know what? I miss you for no reason, or I'm happy for no reason.
Yes.
You know, I'm saying hello for no reason. You know, like, hey, I just came to check on you. What do you want?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, nothing. Like, we lost the or if we ever had, you know, just the idea of just, you know, being genuine and the fact that people can be genuinely and inherently good and loving and supportive and concerned. You know, and so things that, you know, things like motivational interviewing and, you know, we hope calculated conversation can show where the information is missing. You know, and that's why I like what you're doing again, because the idea of, like, I immediately thought of what we were doing when I saw what you were doing. I was like, that's, those two things can't be too far off, because the idea of calculated conversation is assuming that information is missing and we don't have it. And until we get it, we can't make any judgments or any, you can't come up with any ideals yet until we know that.
Right.
And so that's why we really do, man, appreciate what you're doing, man. It's super.
It's mutual.
It's refreshing. It really is, man. So. What about, you know, what other steps, you know, besides the initial, you know, just the diving into your shoes and asking you questions and interviewing you, what other steps do you guys take after, you know, once you get the conversation started? Like, what else is important about MI?
There's things about it that I like that are the kind of compassion and what your intention is when you go into a conversation. But then there's also parts of it that really are strategic, and there is science behind language as well too. So the parts that I like is we start off from an empathetic, compassionate perspective. So I step out of my reality, I step into someone else's reality, and the physics that happens when you step into somebody else's reality without judgment is, instead of it going the direction between two people, so it's not between Can and I or between you and I, when I step into Can's reality, now we're in Can's reality.
Right.
We're in Can's reality, he's not blaming other people. Now he's talking about his struggle or his dilemma. Mm-hmm. So you literally convert this energy that is tension or resistance or discord between two people, and you've converted it into ambivalence.
Right.
And you get access to that ambivalence. And the thing is when people are stuck and they don't know what to do, their natural response is to start blaming and firing at other people.
Right.
So what you can do, and lesson, this is why it works with law enforcement and in these brief conversations in healthcare, it's a simple construct, but we are not trained well at it.
Right.
What it requires is you need to leave your ego behind and step into somebody else's reality, check out, step inside their reality. And when you do that, you've immediately eliminated any resistance. You get access to ambivalence.
Right.
Once you get there, so that's the kind of compassionate side or the empathetic side, then you strategically start to listen to language differently.
Yes.
And in motivational wing, there's four types of language you listen to. There's resistance language, which means they're blaming other people, making about, you know, the government or the president or the community or the teacher or mom or my spouse or my kids. As long as you're blaming outside yourself, that's resistance talk.
Right.
In motivational wing, that's, we identify it that way. And there's a specific way to respond to it. If you respond to it appropriately, all we do then is you label ambivalence. One half is, here's the reasons I'm stuck. And the other side of the hand is, gosh, I wish I would change. Mm. You know, I wish things were different. And so one side's stuck talk, one's change talk. So they call it sustained talk and change talk. So there's resistance talk, sustained talk, change talk. And then there's commitment talk towards behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though this is an effective method of communication, the term motivational learning as an evidence-based method of communication is primarily to affect long-term behavior change,
mm-hmm.
to support long-term behavior
yes.
change. So there's aspects of it you can use in any conversation, but as a model of communication, it's how do we help other people get their behavior in line with their values and goals, and that's their deeper why.
Mm-hmm.
We are not motivated necessarily to go to the gym. We're not motivated to eat vegan.
Right.
Most people don't just wake up and they're like, you know what? I just really want to eat vegan.
Yeah, nope.
They don't get excited about that. And I want to give up all sweets. And, you know, that's not what we're motivated to do. But do you want to be around for your kids?
Right.
Long run? Do you want to be around for your grandkids?
Mm-hmm.
That's what my why is.
Mm-hmm.
That's my motivation.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to hold people accountable to a plan, like, did you make it to the gym today? Did you do what you said you were going to do with your health?
Right.
What you're going to generate, it's mathematic. When you ask, did they do it? They're going to give you excuses why they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So in this method, you don't ask those questions because you don't want to spend any airtime with people giving excuses. So if I'm talking to Ken about his, you know, him wanting to get healthy and be in a different place with that, instead of me saying, well, did you make the gym today? You said you're going to make it 4 days this week. Did you make it all 4 days? His brain literally starts to generate excuses.
Mm.
Instead of saying, you know, what you're still debating is, do I want to get healthy so I can be around for my kids and my grandkids?
Right.
And then Ken says, damn, I need to get back to the gym.
Right.
So it's literally, how do we build internal motivation instead of trying to install it or instill it in an individual?
Mm.
How do you uncover it? And how do you listen deeper to find out what are their motivating factors?
Right.
So
I like that. I want to know if I used it before. So, because I remember we were in OCI last Saturday, and they were asking us about, you know, how do you stay focused, and especially when, you know, people are resistant when they first get out of prison and they don't really have the motivation to change, you know, because of what they're used to, and they don't really see the full term benefits. And so I had a guy come to me and tell me that, you know, like I just, you know, he wanted some support, you know, with employment and whatnot. And basically, I got out and my PO, you know, won't let me go to my son's birthday party. He's turning 9 and I've already missed 7 years of his birthday. I'm not going to miss this one. But, you know, I'm on the ankle bracelet and things like that, you know. And so I had to think on that one for a second. I'm supposed to support him and try to motivate him, right? And so my go-to answer was, well, do you want to be around for his 10th and 11th birthdays?
Absolutely.
Was that am I good?
That's on point.
That's the only thing I think of. Like, that, it just popped in my head. Like, okay, what about 10, 11, and 12 and on?
Exactly.
Okay, you got to do what you got to do at this moment. But let's look at the bigger picture, you know. And that was my biggest... Can I tell you, I think that was my biggest message when I was, you know, at the facility, what the future looks like. What does that look like? Do we have a picture of where we want to end up, and how can we, you know, organize and strategically, you know, create our words and actions to reflect that as we move along?
Exactly.
I think that picture is what a lot of people don't have. So they do whatever they want to at this lower level, not realizing, like you said, the long term effects.
Yes.
And so that's kind of my message, you know, and that's what guides me. You know, I believe in some of the things that Can does is we kind of know what we want things to look like. So we try to make sure our actions are in alignment with that. And that's the idea of calculated conversation as well.
Nice.
Actions and steps, man, and making sure that we know what we want it to equal out to. So we're calculating, you know what I mean?
Yes.
One of the things real quick is that you have mentioned just of words, and I point this out all the time, of one word can change the whole tone structure of a sentence.
Yes.
Right. And I had an example. There's a program I'm a part of, Woke PDX, where get a bunch of people to the table, have conversations about social issues in a place that you can actually have conversations.
Yes.
Right. With that, we were setting up for our first event, and we had a lady who has her own mediation company, and she came in. One of the things we had written out were event rules. She was like, no, that is going to cause people to feel like you're placing rules on them. How about you use community guidelines? That changed the whole feel of what we were asking, the same thing.
Right.
Changed a couple words. Now it's invite. Now it's inclusive.
Right.
Now we're all here. We're together. And this is just kind of what we want to make sure happens tonight.
Right.
And it's simple things like that. And I come across that often.
Yes.
Where it's the way that it's said, more or not, the words being chosen the right way.
Yes.
A lot of times we're just shooting off the hip, coming with the first thing, and sometimes just a breath before responding or actually processing the conversation that you want to have. You know, I know with friends, I get a lot of people coming to me wanting to have conversations with their significant other and so on. That'd be difficult. I always tell them, make bullet points, you know, because the thing that'll happen is the emotions get involved. Then you just start going.
Yes.
And that's where it can get dangerous.
Yes. So, right. Really.
You know, knowing kind of what you want to say and make sure you're kind of putting these things down in a structure that's not, I'm blaming.
Right. Right.
This is you always, you know, the terms we default to. Right.
Yeah.
And trying to just put this more of, I'm coming for the sake of understanding.
Right.
How can we get past this, or at least work on this,
right?
You know, but it's just important. I'm glad you pointed that out. Just the word thing.
Yeah. I like that. I like that too.
Well, there's part of what we were talking about too, Dave, what we were talking about, like, I don't know how far you guys want to go down the rabbit hole.
We got time.
You got time?
We got time today.
Okay. So when you're talking, and Can, this kind of, it segues into it as well too, when you're looking about cultural change, when you're looking at communities, one of the things that I've seen, and you were talking about, you know, individuals that have been incarcerated. One of the things I've been fascinated with in the last couple of years and spending a lot of time researching and diving into is something that's executive functioning, which is our problem solving and coping skills. They call it our executive functioning. When people have experienced trauma, there's significant impact to executive functioning. If somebody sets off a pipe bomb outside this building, your problem solving skills are going to be impacted. So the normal logical way we'd process things will be different when you're under trauma or stress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of individuals that have been incarcerated, a lot of individuals with trauma in their lives, with addiction issues, have experienced a significant amount of trauma. Mm-hmm. When you have a lot of trauma, it has an impact on your executive functioning. I mean, these are actual brain functions. I was just at a conference in Florida and going even deeper into this. And this is what's fascinating, that even through methods of communication, you can have an impact on people's executive functioning. So these individuals you're talking about that are incarcerated, they've been so institutionalized, people that have been on welfare for years, mm-hmm. they're so institutionalized, they don't know how to make decisions when they get stuck in their ambivalence because life does not fall their way.
Right.
And either they've never had the role models for that, their community's never supported it through generations of poverty, through all these different things that have happened to individuals. There's, you know, there's cultural trauma that's happened. There's individual, there's family trauma that happens. That has an impact on our executive function, our problem solving, and our coping skills. And you literally can learn to communicate to help start to repair that. Mm. What everybody wants to do when somebody's struggling with an issue is jump in and give their advice.
Right.
And that doesn't help actually repair executive functionings. It's one more person that's doing something for someone else, which is fine from a compassionate perspective, but it doesn't build up individuals or communities when somebody's always doing it for them and telling them what the solution is.
Right.
It is way harder to have the patience to step back and think, how do I strategically respond to this conversation so I can literally see their brain cells starting to connect and lob some constructs over the top to each other so their brain starts to understand how to problem solve these on their own, and it's not everybody coming in to rescue them, or they're feeling like they're beholden to these systems that are, they're usually are taking advantage of them and capitalizing on them. So this is, I mean, this is a rabbit hole we can go down, but I mean, it's just
I'm here with you.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And I think those are the things that, for me, it moved so far beyond a training or a method of communication. The deeper that I went into this and started to learn and study this, and then see the impact on individuals and communities that I was working with, and then individuals and communities I was training. Like you were talking about, David, the body cam footage. The more I'm working with law enforcement in different areas, it does have a it has such a significant impact. If law enforcement genuinely wants to serve and protect, if that's what you're going to write on the side of your car, is your behavior in line with that?
Right.
If you want to be a good parent, are you going to lay down the meth pipe? I mean, it's just, but there's impact to their executive functioning. So, I mean, there's just these things. It's not just individual. It's not just about, you know, helping people with their diabetes. It's not just about communication and helping with behavior change. I think that's why I was so excited about the whole calculated conversations, you know, being able to have this, in terms of, it really is helping people realize, how do we connect the dots to help ourselves and help people around us?
Right.
And it is through having that, where you're missing information, like how do we fill in these gaps?
Right.
So we all learn and we kind of are all raised up together.
Yes.
Those are the things that just fascinate me about this dialogue that we're having, and then the things that I am, you know, blessed enough to be able to do.
Yeah, man, it's powerful.
So coming up, just rising through your ranks of, you know, working in these different industries, I guess it's all under the same umbrella, but then getting into where you got to having your own business. Mm-hmm. Did you have mentors along the way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all have mentors along the way. And I think there's also something, you know, I think in this day and age, there's so much with podcasts and everybody wants to be the instant millionaire and all the different things, or, you know, find their path. The thing that has always been, you know, I just never thought that I never thought I'd be traveling around the world. I never thought I'd be on a radio show. And, but the mentors for me were people that really did advance my understanding. Is partly it helped me find my humility. Mm-hmm. And then also the same thing, like you guys do with calculated conversations, like filled in the gaps and helped you understand that there's like all of these rungs of the ladder that have been missing for so many people. Like a good mentor shows you how to put those rungs in place for you to climb, and then builds that, instills that in you, the desire to climb further. You know, and it wouldn't be bad. I'd be totally fine if I was still, you know, at a mental health agency or an addiction agency working with people. I'd still be fulfilled.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. But to see 30 or 40 people after 2 days, like, change their thinking and want to, like, literally are thinking about clients they work with and they can't wait to get to work on Monday. That is mind blowing.
Yeah.
That's just mind blowing to me.
It's funny you mentioned podcasts. I listen to a ton of podcasts, read a crazy amount of books, and listen to a lot of podcasts. And one of them yesterday, making dinner, and they were talking about money and transparency with money in the workplace. And there was a experiment that was done where they had everybody's salaries posted. And so with that, it was going, you know, from all your levels, and you're seeing some of the discrepancies in people's pay. And they talked about equating happiness to this. And you had people making 90, 100K, didn't really like their job. You had people that were making 45 and were A-okay.
Yeah.
And they were being fulfilled, though. That's what it boiled down to, is that it was, there were people who didn't have all the money, didn't have the material, but the fulfillment. And that makes me go back to like your parent, the way you were raised, the things they made you guys, they filled you with what they could do, to where you were shielded in a sense of what was actually going on financially.
Yes.
Because the love and stuff never changed.
Exactly.
And that's, I think, that fulfillment piece.
Yes.
And that's when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, where you would be operating at this same level, no matter what context it was in, no matter where you were at, this would be happening. But it's got to be that much better to be able to be at the level that you've gotten to. And that's definitely a nice bonus.
Absolutely. Well, and that's, you know, for podcasts, I mean, we just started posting ours recently, the communication solution.
Okay.
And it's the same thing, is because what we found is it's great training, you know, 30 people at a time, but it's just mind boggling to me. Just, I'm sure as you guys have built your show as well too, it's mind boggling that people listen to it and it actually helps.
Yes. Right.
You know, I think because I don't think I'm the brightest person in the world, you know, I'm not stupid and I'm not the brightest person in the world, but it is phenomenal to me that people find value in the knowledge that I've acquired.
Right.
And that if it helps them get to the next level, that's the mentoring you were asking about earlier, that I think there's times we don't even know we're a mentor.
Right.
Right.
You know, where people come up and just say, oh, this is so impactful. And you're like, I didn't know anybody was even listening to it tonight.
Right.
You
know? Right.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, we get a bunch of, we get a bunch of good messages from different people, oftentimes extremely random. And like a lot of times we just get blown away by, even, you know, we take live phone calls too. Nice. So, you know, we like people putting us on the, you know, up on the chopping block, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So that we, you know, we got to be sure that we believe what we say and that we can answer questions regarding the subject. If we can't answer the questions, and you know, we might be on doing the wrong show. But yeah, we've been overwhelmed by the love and the support, you know, and we do realize, we have noticed the importance, you know, of these conversations, you know, of these philosophies. And so it's important to bring people in to help us expand that, you know, our own minds and our listeners, because most of them, you know, they really starting to become really keen with just the idea of compassion and thinking and calculate and accountability more than anything. These shows really, really push the idea of accountability. They put the power back in your hands.
Nice.
You know, and then, you know, people start to build strength in that, and they're like, man, I'm stronger after listening to you guys. Because, you know, like you said, I don't think we live in a society, you know, that's transparent with us on how much power we actually have over our own lives.
Absolutely.
And we think like you say, everything is just always external. We've always been taught to look around when something don't go right.
Absolutely.
But it's like, the way your life changes when you start to look internally and you're like, oh, I can do that. Like, we surprised to even be here. Like, we didn't know that. We didn't know people was going to listen to us. Absolutely. And that, like, it was going to get to the level where people are like, you really impacted. We love your show. Like, we love this show. And so, again, man, just to be a part of this conversation is just, it's a blessing. And this is what we do and what we want to do, man. And we just thankful that, you know, you guys pulled up.
Absolutely. You know, and when you said that, it was an aha moment for me when I was actually working in, I'd left state prison. I was working in federal prison. And it's the same thing about empowering people, or for them to not realize the power they have. Like, I still remember in one session, I was in a therapy session, and it's the whole thing about, you know, I have no power. My power has been taken away from me. It's been taken away from me my whole life. And I said, do you know you have the power to go throw your jacket over the fence right now and climb over it? You have the power to do that.
Right.
And there's going to be benefits or consequences to that.
Right.
You have all sorts of power. You could go out right now and take a dump in the yard.
Right.
You have the power to, you have all sorts of choices.
Right.
And once you start to realize that, then you can start to be smarter about what decisions do you want to make. So as soon as you start buying into the delusion you don't have a choice, they've won.
You
have all sorts of choices.
Yep.
We literally could turn off the mics right now, hop in the car and drive to Cali.
Right.
We have the choice to do that right now. Right. We literally have the choice to do that right now.
Yes.
But people don't think that they have those choices.
Yes.
Because immediately they get into, well, I can't because I can't because I can't because. And it's like, you are telling, it doesn't mean those aren't real things.
Right.
But do you realize you could if you wanted to?
Right.
And there is benefits and consequences to that. And just to see the thinking of people that have been incarcerated start to realize oh, I do have choices. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want to do when you wake up? You have choices.
Right.
When you start to think that they've taken all your choices away, you are in a not good place. And that's where control shifts mm-hmm. from the masses to the minority, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just like, you need to be really clear.
That's a dangerous spot.
That's a dangerous spot. Absolutely.
Okay. See, how difficult is it? I mean, I think I got a feeling me and Ken have an idea, but I also want to know your opinion. How difficult is it to grow up in this society, you know, being told that you can't, being subject to some of the patterns and some of the traditions that you're raised in, you know, whether it's family, because everyone didn't have the kind of parents that
right.
really supported the idea of love and compassion. Like everybody's right. just even some of our parents was give me and
right.
don't do that. Don't talk to that person. You don't know them, you know, stay away without really giving us any real explanation. I feel like,
right. Right.
which is why we did it anyway. Right. But, but how hard is it, man, for somebody to grow up like this and then say, wait a minute, that doesn't work. You know, I'm going to take more advantage of myself. I'm going to be more internal with things, and I'm going to create my own character, my own way of thinking, my own ideals and philosophies. Like, how is that difficult? Like what?
I think it's that same thing we're just talking about, is first letting your brain open up to the fact that you do have choices. I think we just think we have such limited choices. I was just blown away. I was in a conversation yesterday, actually, with a young man who's come out around his sexuality, and he came over to our house and was having a conversation with us. And the reason he came over to talk with us, just a personal conversation at our house, was because he said, that's not the way I was raised. Like, I was raised, people are bad. Like, you don't have choices. And he said, I just thought I was going to write. He goes, my whole elementary and junior high years, I really thought that you're just going to be miserable because my parents just said, this is the best your life is ever going to be.
Right.
You think you have it hard now? Wait till you have a job and you're paying taxes. You're going to be miserable. Mm. So you think you hate life now? And he said, that's just all I was exposed to. So it was so weird being around my current family for him, because it was like, I just didn't even think this was an option.
Right.
Like, I didn't think people could just wake up and be happy and love their kids and like just make breakfast and then go on walks.
That's
and
crazy.
And have a normal life. I just didn't think that was, I thought that was TV. Because I wasn't raised that way.
Right.
So I think when people get exposed to it, they want it. I was thinking earlier too, David, that ties into this. I remember when I took a year off after I got my master's degree, I took a year off and traveled around Europe, and we were in Ireland. We'd rented a house. I mean, just like the Airbnb, cheap for a month kind of a thing, and to survive for the year we were there. And it was the Dingle Peninsula. I still remember this, in Ireland. And we were in our house for a couple of days. There was me and two people I was traveling with, and there's a knock on our door, and a local fisherman just brought us a bag of fish. And we're like, it's the same thing. Like, what's this about? And it's just like, well, I saw you guys were here, and so I just buy some fish. And we're like, okay, thank you. You know, we're really appreciate it. Then like a day later, two neighbors came over and said, hey, there's a wedding in town today. Do you guys want to go to the wedding and the reception afterwards?
What?
Yeah, exactly.
What?
And we're like, what do you mean? It's like, well, the whole town's going to be there. I mean, these are little towns.
Yeah, yeah.
But you think of a little Irish town.
Wow.
But then you think, well, I want to be like that. Why aren't we like that?
Right.
And I think this is what you're talking about. The further west you go, you know, the difference between east and west, it's so interesting. And there we just hop across the pond to the UK.
Yeah.
And it was so discombobulating. It's just so confusing. But it's like, that's what I want to be part of. Who doesn't want to be part of that?
Right, right.
And when you think about communities that raise their you know, their kids as a community, and there's neighborhoods that used to do that back in the old, you know, when I was a kid, you know, if you got out of line, a neighbor down the street could whap you in the side of the head,
right.
And you get whapped in the head twice when you got to your parents, you know.
Right.
And now it's a lawsuit, you know, and it's just like, where is that gone?
What
and
happened?
I think that's what we want to be part of, is that collective community where people know that it comes from a place of love, and we just all want to bring everybody up to the best possible level. So I think when we know that, I think innately we crave those things. I think we crave having a community.
Yeah.
I think we crave being loved. I think we crave giving love to people. But we're just so afraid it's going to be taken from us.
Yes.
Right.
The other thing that I'll say, you know, as we move into a break, is that the thing that strikes me about this too is the constructs, and I think this is what hit you too, David, is the constructs, when I was teaching them, the constructs are pretty simple, the application are really difficult,
right?
Because it's not the way we normally operate. So I can lay out some of the concepts. It's like, God, that just makes sense. Then you go to do it, and it's like, this is not the way my brain works. It's not the way my mouth works.
Right.
Like, this is harder than I thought it was. So I think it's the same thing about choice. It's great to empower people so they know they have choice, but following through on the steps it takes to get there is harder.
It's a different ball game. Yeah.
We can be successful, but people don't want to do the work that it takes to be successful. Mm-hmm. I was just watching CAN set up, and I think not everybody takes the time to learn all the technology they learn to actually do a podcast well.
Right.
Unless you really want to do a podcast well.
Right.
And people have no clue what happens behind the scenes for you guys to pull this off.
Yes.
No
right.
clue.
Yes.
It's just like, oh, you just flip on your iPhone and you just talk into it and just put it between the two of you at a coffee table.
Right.
That's not the way it works. And do you want to save the money to pay, put out what you need to? And then do you want to have the discipline to make sure that every Tuesday night you guys are putting a product out there? Like, that's people a lot of times don't want to put that effort. And it's not a massive amount of effort, but it takes a conscious effort to do that.
Right.
And then everybody just figures they're going to post it on Instagram and they're going to be famous
that quick.
And make $1 million. And it's like, it doesn't work that way. So I think that's the balance between choice and empowering people. But then you have to have that impetus, that drive inside mm-hmm. of you to, you need to show up every day.
Right.
You need to put one foot in front of the other and keep focused on your why. Then yes. you talk about can. If you stay yes. focused on your why, you may wander off course, but you'll head the right general direction.
Right. right.
Keep your
right.
attention clear.
Right.
So.
That hits on just so many pieces and parts. Again, I'm big on journals. Just. Mm-hmm. I'm big on journals
yeah.
because it's a reference.
Absolutely.
Right. That's something that you can always come back to, go back a few months, go back to last year, see what you were thinking in that moment. And it's also a great progress tracker. I think that's
right.
one
Absolutely.
Of the things when we're headed towards somewhere where we have a goal in mind, it's easy to feel like you're not making progress if
yes.
it's nothing that has happened that's considered major.
Right.
And that's, I think, what it's done the most for me. Is being able to capture that piece and come back and say, no, I actually did. Since then, we've done X, Y, Z.
Yes.
Right.
So may have a whole nother alphabet's worth of letters to go, but we've done this, right?
Well, and you've got it written down because there's so many times there's these brilliant thoughts. Or this is the whole one. The more I've learned about calculated conversations, like the missing pieces.
Right.
You can hear it. You can do the math in your head. But as soon as you go home to do the homework, it's like, what did we talk about today?
Bandwidth. Right. You only have so much bandwidth to work with.
Absolutely. Right. And that yeah. journaling, it makes it so much easier to go yes. back to the reference and be able to pull that back out.
Yes.
Right.
Are we going to get ready to end this part of the episode? But we're coming back with part two.
Part two coming up.
Yes. Calculated conversation.
With Casey Jackson.
So as the gentleman said, you have been listening to Calculated Conversation, KBOO Portland. That was the first part of the interview with Casey Jackson, and the second part will air next week on Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Thank you so much, and stay tuned.
Capabilities, and now I'm living in correctional facilities. Cause some don't agree with how I do this. I get straight and meditate like a Buddhist. I'm dropping flavor, my behavior is hereditary. But my technique is very necessary. Blame it on Ice Cube, because he said it get funky. When you got a subject and a predicate, add it on a dope beat, and it'll make you think. Some suckers just tickle me pink to my stomach, cause they don't flow like this one. You know what? I won't hesitate to diss one or two before I'm through, so don't try to sing this. Some drop science, well I'm dropping English. Even if Yella makes it a cappella, I still express yo, I don't smoke weed or sex. Cause it's known to give a brother brain damage, and brain damage on the mic don't manage nothing but making a sucker in you equal. Don't be another sequel. Spread yourself. For the pop chart, so where should a brother like you start expressing yourself, my boy, and show you how your track,
what up,
drop English right about now. Getting back to the PG, that's program, and it's easy. Dre is back, new jacks a
are made hollow. Expressing ain't the subject because they like to follow the words, the style, the trend. The records I spin again and again and again. Yo, you're on the other end. Watch your brother blend dope rhymes with no help. There's no fessing or guessing while I'm expressing myself. It's crazy to see people be what society wants them to be, but not me. Ruthless is the way to go, they know. Others say rhymes which fail to be original, or they kill where the hip-hop starts. Forget about the ghetto and rap for the pop charts. Though some musicians, cuz at home, they're scared to use profanity when up on the microphone. Yeah, they want reality, but you hear none. They'd rather exaggerate a little fiction. Some say no to drugs and take a stand, but after the show, they go looking for the dope man. Or they ban my group from the radio here in WA and say hell no. But you know it ain't all about wealth, as long as you make a note to spread yourself.
Phantom of the dark walk through my heaven with levitation from reefers drenching deep as an E7 showboating with rugas, flash vines, Belafonte jigger. Let's get for what this worth as we confiscate your figures.
Chasing over brown, levitating jiki and dashikis, the Lahada car 54, chasing diamond runners headed ice band. The big chiller diamond convention, Harlem buck strut, freezing world heist, Hollywood, Madam Butterfly. Let me in your house, a pleasure from the knuckle swatch, shadow boxes catching black eye blue.
I play the thief, what? Sensations at the Monte Gras, we screaming Chiba. Fulfilling pleasures in my castle, blow the smoke out. The Garza Vega substitutes when the Dutch is gone. The load don't stop, give me shouts, it's the season. Sauteas, souffleas for swerving no corners. We madness to moolah, living with Charlie's Angels on us. No smiling when sliding, that gets you caught up in the octa or dead if we're moving. It's just like that as we proceed.
Saturday night special, better take it light. You Jaja, you're a Capitan. Quest to the coast, the Key Largo, wire the chain gang. Keep your ears out for a year. Sip the fountain blue, house of bamboo, paradise.
This is it, what? Luchini pouring from the sky, let's get rich, what? The cheeky vines and sugar dimes, can't quit, what? Now pop the cork and see the Vega and get lit, what? This is it, what? This is it, what? Luchini pouring from the sky, let's get rich, what? The cheeky vines and sugar dimes, can't quit, what? Now pop the cork and see the Vega and get lit, what? What? What?
Fallen sparrows heard the seas of black Caesar to convince a silky days. Satin nights taking flight, Dino going. Sweet sensation, Spanish flying with the lady Scarface. Bottoms up, sunshine, love potion number
and we
9.
And from the magic city, transcending sweeter on your aura. Fancini in London, relaxation in Bora Bora. Got notion to bring it, sing it. Never been my function, stoning, robbing. We heisting merchandise and gunning. Love it, leave it, but bless the war chief for his bison. Get it, got it, the low will forever be nice.
Yeah, the sunny fever, he be sipping on my red duh. The Geechee gracious, he be sipping on my red duh. We float the tri-state draped in the satin vines. This coolie hijack pack from the sugar shack. Then what we do after we sip the armor red duh? We start the Harlem River quiver, digging sweet daddy. Sharpen the crimson blade, high Sierra serenade. Anatomy for seduction, be this ebony
yeah, as
junction.
As we exit the place with grace, just the armor rather the bursting of clouds. It pours, everything seems better on flats with love. We move only in the mist. It's slow, it's life, and we can't get enough yeah, of this. This is it, what? Luchini pouring from the sky, let's get rich, what? The Geechee vines and sugar dimes, can't quit, what? Now pop the cork and see the Vega and get lit, what? This is it, what?
This is it, what? Luchini pouring from the sky, let's get rich, what? The Geeky Vons, the Sugar Dimes, can't quit, what? Now pop the cork, Christina Vega, and get lit, what? This is it, what? This is it, what?
The Shiny Keeper, he be sipping on my red dye. The Geeky Vicious, he be sipping on my red dye. The Joe King, he be sipping on my red dye. The Chiquita, yeah, he be sipping on my red dye. We got Steve Fumanti, we're on my red dye. And then my man, Ill Will, slip on my red dye. And then my man, Kevin, the same, slipping that. We slide through the tri-state with the hi-hat. And then I float side to side in my coolie high. And then I do something with the Spanish fly, yeah. And then I float down south with the boogie flats. And then I slide up in between the sticky boy off and all of that, yeah.
This is KBOO Portland.
Club going up on a Tuesday. Got your girl in the cut and she choose. Ain't club.